Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Yours, and as always, I'm your host, Deirdre Schuler, and we were just listening to Dance from Antigua by King Short Shirt. Well, you know, fall is upon us, so we can look at all the lovely colors the divine painter has placed upon his or her godly palette. And you know, I hardly ever feature a painter on my show, so I'm delighted to have as my guest today a painter, a writer, someone who writes lyrics and poetry, and is a playwright to boot. And my guest today, Iyaba Ibo Mandingo.
How are you, my dear?
Back. I'm sorry?
How are you doing, my dear?
I'm doing well. And I want to say that you are from, you're an award winner that's born in Antigua. And you're here today to tell us your story and about your play, Unframed, A Man in Progress. I believe that's an 80-minute play, but if I'm wrong, you can correct me. And it consists of poetry and prose and painting. And I also want to mention that your show is going to be at the Gerald W. Lynch Theater, and that's at John Jay College, which is located at 899 10th Avenue in New York City. And that's going to be on Thursday, September 22nd at 1:30 p.m. and Friday, September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. and Saturday, September 24th at 7:30 p.m. But we'll repeat that again. And as you can hear, Mr. Mandingo is with us, and he has also brought along his director, Brent Buell. So welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hi. Thank you for having me. That was a very, very, very lovely introduction. The Mighty King Short Shirt was actually the very first musician that I fell in love with. His record shop was right across the street from my grandmother's house. So as a boy, I spent a lot of time behind that counter and on the counter and listening to him. He's awesome. He's awesome. The minute I heard his voice, I knew who that was.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
One of our greatest musical contributions to the world is the Mighty King Short Shirt.
And that's Mr. Mandingo saying this?
Yes.
Oh, okay, because we have two guests. I just want to make sure.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Mandingo, I understand that you are a three-time winner of the Yale University Martin Luther King Birthday Invitation Slam. But what is that exactly?
Well, it's actually something that one of my elders and a really good friend of mine in Goldman Hill put together about 15 years ago, and it was something definitely to honor Dr. King's birthday. And my generation, we do this thing called slam, which is competitive poetry. So we use some of the elements of that, and instead of having it be it can become very individualistic. It was, you know, it's very themed out. So we look for social themes, and, you know, poets that day, they have to come and do things that are talking about social environmental justice. And you're judged by, you have a scoring system, sort of an Olympic kind of scoring system, and highest points mean that you are the champion. And I was lucky enough to do that three times, actually.
Well, congratulations. And I saw that you again did it with the Connecticut Grand Slam, winning it twice that time, right?
Yes. Well, in the Connecticut Slam, now that's the part of the National Slam competitions. And, you know, once you win, They designate a Grand Slam champion as somebody that's got, you know, the highest cumulative score over that entire poetry season, a couple of months, and then you go and represent the state with a four-man team, as a part of a four-man team at the Nationals. And this year here they were in Boston, but, you know, they've been in Rhode Island and Seattle and most of the country.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah. Very cool, very cool. I don't slam as much anymore. I'm a little bit too sensitive for the competition. I think I don't really do that well with somebody telling me that my poem was only a 3 or 4, and then having some kind of weird opinion on why. So I actually sort of retired from slamming and took up playwriting and really a venue where I could. My poetry is very storytelling and message oriented socially, and so this venue just allows me more freedom to do that, and I don't have to worry about judges and scores, and, you know, I don't have to worry about being distracted and sort of forgetting the purpose for the talent. You know, I definitely don't think that we get the talent to compete with each other. I think, you know, I believe poets like myself or artists like myself, our job is for making the place, the planet, a better place, you know, helping people.
It's unfortunate that as artists, especially as writers, you're always being critiqued.
Oh, yeah.
Criticized or praised.
Yes.
And that goes along. It's called paying dues, as ugly
as that
feels.
Oh, yeah, well, that comes with this also, because reviewers can be just as unnice as judges. But then we like the nice ones, like winning the
Excellence in Theater Award in Washington, D.C. this summer, so at the D.C. Black Theater Festival. So that was mighty nice.
And you were also awarded, I didn't understand, what is a national percent for the arts program, artist grant? What does that mean,
well,
awarded a national percent?
That's something that the National Endowment for the Arts does, the public grants that are done, you know, schools and public buildings, whatever city, state and city that project is going to happen in, they are obliged to inform the local artists, and 1% of whatever that total grant for that building or park or whatever that thing is, that, you know, as long as it's publicly funded, then they inform the artists, who are then put through a process of, you know, a process of elimination where, you know, they whittle it down to one final person who then comes in and does something representative of that new building. So this is actually a new elementary school that they were building in New Haven that was going to be built in the place of an older school that had been there since the 30s. And they kept some of the front of it and just added on two more blocks of building. So I actually ended up getting the commission to do 17-year-old inside of the school, the new constructed school. So, you know, once the building was up, before the kids came in, I painted the 17 pieces in my studio, and then I went with a team of friends and installed it there at the school.
Wow, that sounds great.
Oh, it was awesome. It's actually one of the coolest projects I've done. It was actually also the project that my West Indian family is going to be very conservative and sort of immigrants. When you're an immigrant, the child of an immigrant, and you tell your parents you want to be an artist as opposed to a doctor and a lawyer, their reaction is not very nice, let's say. And so that was very cool because it was a pretty large grant. So that check, I remember when I got the first half of the check, I took a photocopy of it and sent it around to all my family. And then after that, they were like, okay, you can actually make a living from this. Okay, you're an artist. And so that was really
cool.
Well,
I've got to tell you, that's not just a West Indian thing. Most people, when a kid tells their parent, I want to be an artist instead of a doctor or a lawyer, they frown.
Oh,
and it's unfortunate.
Well,
I'm sorry?
On our way here, those were the only two choices we were given, either doctor or lawyer. And all the way through elementary and high school and college, those were still the only choices that were persuasively recommended, let's say. Doctor,
you mean
lawyer.
Not Indian chief?
There's no Indian chief.
Oh, well, they missed out.
Yeah, well, you know, they came around. They've all come around since, and they're actually my biggest support system right now, so that's awesome.
Well, speaking of your family, and tell me about your background.
Well, I was born in Western.
Can you speak up a little?
I was born in Antigua.
Uh-huh.
I spent the first 11 years there living in my grandmother's house with my mother, you know, typical third world extended family. My mother was the last of her siblings to leave. She really did not have any intention of leaving, but my grandmother passed away, and her siblings, her other six siblings, ganged up on her and sort of convinced her that coming to America was the best thing for my sister and brother and I. And so we left in 1980 and moved to America. And like a lot of West Indians at that time, they were sort of heeding the call for, you know, workers in America. We lived for about 7 years as illegal aliens. And in 1980, about halfway through the 80s, Reagan had the amnesty for anyone that could tell, you know, proof that they had been here since 1980. We fit that criteria. And we were given our eventual temporary residencies, which, you know, kind of led to some of the play, which, you know, because there was a lawyer that wasn't a very honest lawyer that took my mother's money and never filed our paperwork. So eventually, once that 40-month time period that they gave us to file for permanent residency elapsed, we got a letter telling us we had 30 days to leave, and you know, we had to enlist a congressman to get INS to reopen the case. And
how old were you then?
I was about 18, 19 years old, our freshman year in college, about that happened.
Oh, okay. Because I saw somewhere, but I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. What was it like growing up in a single parent home? Because I understand nearly 60% of African Americans and Caribbean children grow up without their fathers. Is that something that you observed while living in Antigua?
Oh, definitely. It was definitely something that I observed. My father left to come to America when I was 4 years old, and his intentions were coming to sort of prepare and make a better life for us here, and some of those things didn't work out. But I don't know if a void was the right way to put it, because my grandfather was there every day, and I actually called him daddy, and my uncles were around. You know, they were male figures. I just didn't have my dad there, but, you know, there wasn't a missing thing, because, like I said, my grandfather, he stepped in and completely took over that role.
So what were the struggles that they say you experienced? Was that in Antigua or in America?
Struggles that they say I experienced struggles. Well, I think that was the coming here, I think, maybe, you know, I don't know. Struggles are kind of that's a very big.
Well, they say the racism you experienced reading your bio.
And, you know, you grew up in an island where it's, you know, the majority of the people are black. You don't really, other than, you know, the intra-race prejudice, which is, you know, light skin, dark skin, good hair, bad hair. I knew that stuff, but I did not know white to black prejudice or racism until I moved to America. And that was the biggest thing, because I am very dark-skinned and my features are very African. So I definitely, just adjusting to being here in America, where I went from being one looking like everybody else in my island and coming up here and sort of being singled out because of my complexion and because of my features. That took me a really long time to get over. And I guess in a lot of ways, there's some stuff I still have there, yes. So, you know,
all I can say to that is welcome to America.
Yes, well,
as an ethnic, this is what all ethnic groups experience.
Well, you know, I think today is the 14th. And I think
today's the 13th.
Yeah, 13th. Well, in five days, it'll be 31 years since I've been here, so I've definitely been seasoned and marinated properly with it by now.
You know.
Yes, I do.
Well, is that why you sought? Well, how did your mother manage financially, because you had a good family support?
Yes, system? My mother worked. My mother, you know, she had a job. She sang with a group, a singing group that, you know, they made money that way. Also touring the West Indies, and my grandparents were both artists. My grandmother was a seamstress that actually one of the best in our area. So she. Work was pretty steady, and my grandfather was a tailor, so economically.
So there was always artist and craftsmen in your family?
Yeah, yes.
So you came by it naturally?
Yes, well, now, especially now looking back in hindsight, I definitely realized that I definitely came from it. My grandfather, for example, it wasn't until I was an adult that I went digging into his albums and actually realized that he was an artist, and he just, you know, a man born in 1925, a black man born in 1925, he just took a practical approach, which was to become a tailor. But, you know, when you watch the way he cut cloth, and when you watch the way he would throw, you know, people's expensive material up on a table, and you watch them sort of gasp as he took out the tailor chalk and just start drawing on it without measurements or anything, and then cutting it that same kind of way, you know, I now realize that this man was an artist, and, you know, I'm actually blessed to be alive in a time where, you know, I don't have to go, oh, I can't do that because, you know, I'm not going to make a living. You know, it's tough, but I can actually make a living doing this now. So
yeah.
I'm definitely.
Well, what led you to that? Were you already doing painting and art and poetry in Antigua, or you started it when you came to America?
I was doing a lot of visual stuff in Antigua, a lot of drawing, and a lot of my biggest problem when it came to that was taking my mother's foil paper, or aluminum foil. I stole that on a regular basis because I could mold it into everything. So I was always making little worlds, people and animals and vehicles out of aluminum foil that my mother would eventually find out I did when there was no foil paper left on the roll. So that was my biggest form of creativity as a kid. It was definitely the foil paper people and a lot of drawing, a lot of comic book tracing. But just always... most comfortable doing that. So when I came to America in the fifth grade and you know, walked into Miss Bailyn's art class that first day or, you know, that first week of school and saw all the stuff that she had, all the different materials, it was my first time seeing so many different things. I was in love instantly. And from the fifth grade right through college, it was, yeah, I always.
Well,
always,
I read somewhere that you weren't so happy about coming to America. Is that, and that prompted a poem called "Mommy, Me No Wanna Go to America"?
Yes, that's not bad. The pipe was not bad, and that's also in the show. That poem is from the show. It's "Mommy, Me No Wanna Go to America," and I didn't want. I was 11 years old. Antigua is a very beautiful place. My grandfather was my hero and, you know, still is. I thought it was awesome being around him. You know, I was his apprentice, so I would come home from school and spend hours in the tailor shop hanging out with him. And it was sunny all the time, and there were fruit trees everywhere. And I was not that intrigued with seeing snow. Or I'd talk to my cousins on the phone and heard about how cold it gets. I didn't want to leave. It was awesome. And I had just actually gotten to my first girlfriend, just finally had a girlfriend. And I think 2 days after she finally said, yes, we can be boyfriend and girlfriend, and here comes Mommy with this news about wanting to go to America. I was completely opposed.
Well, I'm sure you were devastated.
Yes, I was. I was very,
but I bet you made up for it once you got here.
Yes, well, eventually. Eventually I made up for it once I got here, eventually. But, you know, I'm here, you know, life's a circle, so I'm actually... this year, I think I've been to Antigua 4 or 5 times. I'm very much back in love with the place and very much in the process of making it possible for me to spend, you know, some of the time of the year there and the rest up here.
Well, it's definitely due to this economy, it's great to be able to go somewhere else.
Oh, yes. And the winter, I still, you know, it's 31 years later, I still am not a big fan of snow and cold.
Well, let me ask you what led you to write your play, Unframed, A Man in Progress?
All of those things, definitely, but just getting to this place where I had so many friends who knew that I was a poet and other friends that knew that I was a painter, and there wasn't very much overlap. And so that was the sort of the nexus of the thing. I wanted to figure out a way that I could share all of me, you know, do poetry and the painting, and have all of my friends realize that I do both things. And so I was like, I'll try that on stage. And the very first time I did it, you know, it went off well, I thought, until one of my friends who was in the audience, who has a master's degree in theater, came up to me and said, that was excellent. The poetry was amazing, and I cannot believe that you can actually paint while you're talking to people at the same time. But you just broke one of the first rules of theater. I was like, what's that? He said, well, you had your back to the audience for almost 2 hours. So that was, you know, that was like my first oops. So we traded a painting, and he spent some time with me and sort of started breaking me into some of the rudimentaries of the theater and the stage. And I just loved the freedom and of all the things that you can do as an actor, performer on stage. Just blew my mind, because you can do everything, and everything, all the things I love doing, the singing, the dancing, the poetry, the painting, the acting, it's all, the stage is the one place where you can do all of these things. You know, in the poetry venue, you can be a poet. In the gallery, you can be a painter. You know, there's no compartmentalizing on the stage. So that, to me, was like, hey, you can, I've always had like sort of a multidisciplined approach to my artistic expression. So it was like, hey, I think I found home. And
you're producing it, right, in collaboration with Double Play Connections?
Well, I'm actually not.
Live Productions?
Well, they are producing it. That's my director and my producer. My director is doing live productions. So he's directing.
Well, he's here with us, so let him tell us about that.
Yes.
He's involved.
Well, the story of the journey of Unframed is really great. About it was nearly 11 years ago, I was volunteering teaching prisoners at Sing Sing to act, and we were doing a stage adaptation of Richard Stratton's film Slam, which is about a young slam poet who's incarcerated, and it's built around the poetry of Saul Williams. And the producer, in order to assist with that, brought in one of the nation's important slam poets to teach our leading man, who was a prisoner, how to do slam poetry, and that was Ayaba Iba Mandingo. So we met that night, and to introduce himself to the men, he did a poem 41 times, which is about the murder of Amadou Diallo by the New York City police. And I, at the time, was very involved in that case, working with Al Sharpton around that case. And so I was tremendously affected by what that poem and what was said. And as we were walking out of the prison that night, Ayaba turned to me and he said, you know, someday I'm going to write a play about my life, and you're going to direct it.
Wow.
And I said, you know, okay. 9 years later, he called and said, remember that play I told you about at Sing Sing? And I said, yeah. And he goes, it's ready. Come on up and see it. So my wife and I went up to Harlem and saw it at the Casa Frehley Gallery, and I loved it immediately and came on board as director and producer. And about 6 months later, I guess, Ayaba and I had the chance to do an industry performance, and that is where our executive producer, Jane Dubin, who's a Tony Award-winning Broadway producer, heard it, and she fell in love with it and optioned the play, and we've been working together ever since. And we've been touring out of town. We've done 25, 26 performances out of Manhattan, working on the play. And
is this in other states?
Yes, and we've done it in Connecticut, New Jersey,
Massachusetts,
and other boroughs of
Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and other boroughs of New York City, but not in Manhattan before. And now we are coming in and going to have these three performances at the Gerald Lynch Theater, which is just this gorgeous theater that I've always loved. It's a great theater, and people have a chance.
It's within John Jay College, right?
Yes, it is. And people have a chance to see a really extraordinary play. I think quite unlike anything people have seen before. I know it was for me, and I see a lot of theater, but when I saw this, I thought I've never seen anything like this, and I've never heard a message that took me so powerfully. And it cuts across all lines, economic, racial, everything. We've been playing this in front of very divergent audiences, and whether it's an all-black audience or a Caribbean audience or an all-white wealthy audience up in Westchester, it reads differently to people, but people love the play, and I think come away greatly educated and kinder as a result of seeing it. So
mm-hmm.
I'm
so
very
cool.
Excited to be on board.
Well, I wanted to ask, I read somewhere that you almost got deported, Mr. Mandingo, after 911. What was that about?
Okay, first thing is, please call me Ayaba. I just realized you were calling me Mr. Mandingo. I did turn 42 a couple of days ago, but I don't want to be Mr. Mandingo yet.
I'm sorry?
I don't want to be Mr. Mandingo yet. I just turned 42 about 3 days ago, but so please, Ayaba is fine. But
okay.
I was actually deported 3 days after the invasion of Afghanistan in 2004, three, I believe. Yeah, I was. I did a concert in Connecticut. This is also in a part of the play. These are everything that we talked about. You know, what we've done over the last year together, and what I did before that when I was working on it by myself was just. Put all of those stories into this thing that we're now calling a play, and what has happened, meeting Brett and Jane, is that they've really helped me to, put into this really beautiful thing that's really correlated and tells the story that you and I are speaking about now. But, 9/11 happened, America invades Afghanistan, I, being a socially conscious poet, very upset with that, especially some of the attitudes that I was experiencing at the time, very, very xenophobic. And the poem I wrote was in reaction to that attitude that I felt. And it was a very angry poem. I don't think too angry. I think it was actually very befitting to the time period. But it did not rub the audience the right way. So there was a lot of complaining. There was quite a few editorials, actually, the next few days in the newspaper. A lot of people made phone calls complaining about the things I was talking about. And 3 days later, the immigration came and arrested me. Now, what they said was that it just happened to be a coincidence because, as we talked about earlier, that lawyer that had misrepresented my family, they're saying that because of all those things, my paperwork hadn't officially gone through yet. And many years before, I had a child with a white sister in Iowa. Her parents threw me in jail until she ran away, and they had to drop the charges. But they said, based on, under the Patriot Act, based on the fact that I had been arrested in Iowa for what I was then being accused of, which was being was rape, under the Patriot Act, I am not, which was, yeah, and that was all eventually thrown out, of course, but, you know, the government saying, you know, the Patriot Act at that time, I don't know if you remember that time period, it was very sort of a blanket thing, you know, there were no loopholes or special cases, everything was thrown into the same bucket, so I ended up in that same bucket, and they basically said that it was an aggravated felony, whether or not it was ever taken to trial, and they have the discretion to decide that I do not deserve to be an American citizen. So they were going to deport me.
And how did you got a lawyer to avoid that?
Well, yeah, the lawyer to me was sort of gravy, was the gravy. The way I avoided that because my mother was right. My mother had always drilled into my head that if you do good, you get good. Actually, that's exactly her saying, you do good and you get good. And that's what I did. All, you know, when I graduated out of college, I came back home to my community and went into the inner cities and volunteered in the community centers. So I, by that time, it had been almost 14 years of me working with pretty much every principal in my school. I was personal friends with the mayor and his wife because I did art shows at their home. That they did fundraiser-type things. Most of the community leaders knew who I was. Most of the newspaper people knew who I was because I was probably one of the most visible inner-city people when it came to what I was doing in my community. So that's who helped me. Yes,
and now his director jumps in and says, to find out exactly what happened, people have got to see the show.
Exactly.
I agree.
His director's name is Brent Buell, by the way, so
yes.
Who was just talking. But we're unfortunately, the clock has struck the final hour, and all things must come to an end, even those good things.
Oh, yes.
So before we close, I want to again tell interested parties that your show, Unframed, A Man in Progress, is going to be featured at Gerald W. Lynch Theater, which is within John Jay College, and that's located at 899 10th Avenue, folks. And that's going to be on Thursday, September 22nd at 1:30 p.m. and on Friday, September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. and Saturday, September 24th at 7:30 p.m. And tickets are reasonable at $20, $10 for students. And they're available at www.ticketcentral, and that's spelled out, CENTRAL.com. Or you can call 212-279-4200.
And they also have 56 of my paintings are also on display. They were doing my latest three series, so they also get a chance to come and see the visual art. Again, right back to what we're talking about. I now know how to do everything, so you can come and see my artwork visually. You can come and hear my artwork, and you can come and feel my artwork. So definitely come and check it out.
And they can view your work on www.unframedtheplay.com.
Yes.
So thank you again, gentlemen, for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buell, Brent Buell, and thank you, Ayaba Ibo Mandingo.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you.
And we're going to end the show with thanking my audience for making my topic topically yours. And this is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. I'm Deirdre Schuler, and we are going to end topically yours with Postcard from Antigua.
All right, sister. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
sit at the hotel desk with a brown-skinned girl in a floral print dress on the sun-drenched island with the fine white sand where my love and I walked hand in hand. You can stand waist-deep in the turquoise sea while the palm trees rustle in the tropical breeze, but that breeze won't help you when the sun gets high. Then it's SPF 30 or you're gonna fry. Hello from old Antigua. Here is a postcard from Antigua. Life's a beach in old Antigua. We had us a great time. Wish we were there.
Performed by Josh Duffman.
This postcard hung out for a couple of days, then was taken into town in the usual way. Past goats and chickens and one-room shacks, over car-eating roads that could break your back. Where they drive on the left and there are no signs. The views are splendid, but the curves are blind. There's something waiting for you over every hill. And if a cow doesn't stop you, then a pothole will. Hello, old Antigua. Here is a postcard from Antigua. Life's a beach in old Antigua. We had us a great time. Wish we were there. Now when the sun goes down, you can find your way by the light of the moon and stars. The tree toads chime, the mosquitoes dine, and the geckos patrol the bars. And you can sip coladas by the waterside, float away on the island rum, or make love to the thunder of the rolling tide and the air conditioner's hum. And God bless the air conditioner. This postcard arrived when a month had been spanned. We were back on the case, we were losing our tans. Hadn't taken much more than a couple of days for the salt and the sanity to wash away. But we looked at the picture and it made us smile. That was it for conversation for a little while. Postcards are great things to keep around. Now it's time to start saving for our next trip down. Hello, old Antigua. Here is a postcard from Antigua. Life's a beach in old Antigua. We had us a great time. Wish we were there in old Antigua. Here is a postcard from Antigua. Life's a beach in old Antigua. We had us a great time. Wish we were there.
Sand and the moon.
And I wish we were there.
Music from a distance.
Just you and me.